Hello, this is Bianca Westwood from Gillette Soccer Saturday on Sky Sports, and you are listening to the V2 Football Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the V2 Football Podcast. I'm Chris Lappin and I'm delighted to be joined by Mark Wilson. How are you doing this morning, Mark?
I'm doing very well, mate. I'm doing very well, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, for those who don't know, Mark is a midfielder who used to play for Man United, Middlesbrough, Doncaster Rovers and is currently coaching in America. So, firstly, how were you spotted by United?
It was through it was actually through my pathway to Lillishall. Back in 1994, I think. Well, going back some years there. I was basically playing for Grimsby Town as a 13-year-old. They suggested I go to the trials to see if I could get into Lillishall, which was the FA National School of Excellence. So during those trials, there were a number of clubs that that approached me about signing for them. And obviously, the further down the line you get towards being accepted into the FA National School of Excellence, the more it heats up a little. And Manchester United were my childhood team, surprisingly, given the fact I'm from Scunthorpe. there were two kits being bought or were bought for myself and my brother as kids. One was a Liverpool one and one was a United one. Then it was the 80s at the time. So my brother was oldest. He got first pick, took the Liverpool kit. And I got left with the Man United kit, so in the end it worked out okay. But I was scouted by a guy called Ron Cattell. During those trials, and as a 14-year-old, I signed schoolboys and spent the next 7 years with the club, which was a phenomenal experience.
Eric Harrison comes up a lot when I speak to ex-United trainees. Did he have a huge influence on your career?
He did. Yeah, Eric was huge. He I think psychologically, Eric certainly had a real influence on me. He was very tough, very direct, but he had this manner like the gaffer where he could make you feel 10 feet tall with a compliment or two, because they were very fleeting. They were very few and far between. But he drove you to want more and be better. And he also, in a roundabout way, without being a psychologist, he taught you to deal with adversity by putting you in situations in practice where he would create, you know, little moments of pressure for you as a player, even in practice, and he'd certainly do it in games. So, he was certainly influential in my early development.
Yeah, so looking back, it must have been an amazing experience to play and train with the likes of Giggs and Beckham and Scholes. Do you have any favourite memories?
Favourite memories? You know what, probably two. There's so many. 10 games in what turned out to be 4 years is a terrible ratio of Premier League games when you spend that amount of time at a club. But, the Champions League games in particular, just walking out on a Tuesday or a Wednesday night in front of that crowd. And my dream midfield was obviously Scholes, Beckham, Giggs and myself. Yeah. And I got to play in it. So at the time, it's very normal. And if it was anything other, I don't think anybody would be stood in that tunnel with the likes of those players. And it was just the European nights was something very unique for me. It was almost at that point, the league games were a formality.
Being around the club in 1999 must have just been amazing.
It was just a phenomenal experience to play and train at that level in particular. And what you could argue, or certainly looking at my career as I left United, did I ever get back to that level again? Did I ever get back to that standard? And there's a lot of layers you could peel back and ask why, why didn't I get back to that level, or if I did continue to play that level for some time after. But a unique experience, a very humbling one to look back on, and something I'll take with me to the grave.
So you joined Middlesbrough. Was Steve McLaren a big part of why you joined the club?
He was, Steve was reasonably influential for me at United. He put a bit of faith in me as a youngster, along with John Curtis and Jonathan Green in. And the year after we won the treble, we went on a tour to the Far East, and Steve played me quite a bit, and I did well. I felt comfortable. Felt like I started to deserve my place in and around the first team, and just trying to cement a regular spot. It was always going to be difficult, but Steve, gave me the belief and confidence, and I had that myself to want to try and push for that. So when Steve left and went to Middlesbrough, he obviously took myself and Jonathan Green in there. It was an interesting time. I was an attacking central midfielder. I actually went to United as a centre forward, then became an attacking central midfielder before snapping my Achilles in what arguably should have been my breakthrough year, but it only set me back 4 or 5 months. So when I went to Middlesbrough, I went as a midfielder that turned into a holding midfielder. So it was about learning a different element and different perspective on the game from playing that position, from being so attacking to being so defensive, and being a link man. And Steve certainly helped with that. Tactically, he was excellent on the field. He was a fantastic coach, delivery-wise, and he certainly helped that transition from me being an attacking midfielder, a bit of an injury, and making sure I could adapt and adjust my game to continue to play in the Premier League. Although, the ratio again to years and games is not ideal, it's still an enjoyable 4 years at Middlesbrough, certainly.
Yeah, so you went out on loan a number of times during your time at Middlesbrough. Did you find this frustrating, or were you just happy for the chance to play first team football?
No, I found it very frustrating. Yeah. It was a case of, I certainly think there was an immaturity in myself as a player when I was younger. Rather than, even if I did deserve to stay in the side and the team after certain performances, and I expected to be afforded the privilege of being played through my bad spells, and other players have had that through their career, but it wasn't the case for me. So instead of approaching it with I've got to find a problem to this solution in the right way, working out on the training field and performing well in reserve games, and I did do that for the most part. I certainly think those moments of adversity when I thought I was playing well and warranted my first team spot, I didn't deal with it well mentally, and that was just an immaturity for me as a young player, and you kind of start to blame the other factors around yourself. So it's the manager's fault, it's the assistant manager's fault, I just played a great game and we won a few games on the run in the Premier League, and then you find yourself out of the team, it's not fair. And it's more of a hard luck story you start telling yourself in your mind, and that affects your continued development and certainly affects your consistency. So, as a young player going through that, I certainly would look back and say that lack of appearances or the lack of consistency in my play was down to a psychological immaturity.
So after Bennett Willsby went and had a season in the MLS with FC Dallas, what prompted the move to America?
I'll be honest, complete frustration with the game here in England.
Yeah.
And it was a case of going away and clearing my head. Everybody was asking, why are you 25? Why are you going over there? You've just left a Premier League team. And it was more about finding my spark, my inspiration and my passion for the game. Then actually caring where I was and how it was perceived. And in the end, I think it was the right choice. Mm. Again, we talk about perceptions and how we're viewed as a player or the choices we make, but I think the choices you make for yourself are the most important ones. And did it reignite my passion for the game? Did it give me that inspiration to continue and enjoy the game again? Absolutely. Absolutely. And personal circumstances meant that I didn't stay out here family-wise. Family didn't quite settle. And I ended up going home after 2 years. I probably would have liked to have stayed, but it wasn't the case. So I came home, I think in 2006, 2007, looking for a new club.
Yeah, is playing abroad something you'd recommend for recently released younger players?
I would. I think the MLS is a league that's continuing to grow and expand. And yes, it's a different style. It's not quite as high tempo, high contact as say the Championship or the Premier League, but they're technically some phenomenal US-based players and a lot of Latin American players who are technically very good and quick and used to the heat over here when we play through the summer. It was a great experience for me, and I look where the game is started here in the MLS, in the new league. Probably, I think it's been going 15, 16 years now, and my period in 2005 to 2007, where it was just starting to build momentum, you you look at it now, the game's exploded here in the US. It's an exciting place to be for one, player development, and two, the development of the MLS League and the US national team.
So after that you joined Doncaster. During an exciting time in the history of them just moving to stadium, did it feel like the club was on the rise when you joined?
It felt like it was on the rise only because of my own personal view and opinion.
Yeah.
Because of the manager that was at the helm, and having spent a short period with Sean O'Driscoll just on trial, I realised he was a guy who thought very differently about the game. Somebody I could learn from, along with Richard O'Kelly, who I worked with at Grimsby as a youth team player, as a 12 or 13 year old. Between both of them, I felt I had a lot to learn, and I knew at some point I had to adjust my mentality and understanding of the game to one, find some consistency, and two, you know, to eventually transition out of the game into being a coach in some capacity. So I kind of felt that this club was on the verge of something unique, and Sean and Richard built a team of players that were, you know, hungry to succeed, and created a style of play that was just a lot of fun to play.
Yeah, it must have been nice to be close to your hometown as well. Mm.
Yeah, it was.
It's only 20 miles away, isn't it, from Scunthorpe?
Yeah. It is, but in that instance, I became like the villain as well, because it's like I've come home all the way from the US and signed for the club down the road. There wasn't any interest from Scunthorpe at the time anyway, so it's kind of like, where's Mark Wilson been for a year and a half, 18 months, you know, 2 years? So I came back, and then Doncaster offered me the opportunity, and it was nice to live at home, certainly. But Scunny, you know, Scunthorpe United were the rivals.
And thankfully,
I never lost to them.
So the club won their Football League trophy, whatever it was called at the time, I'm not sure. Was it Johnson's Paint?
I think it was, yeah, it was Johnson's Paint.
So what's it like when you're in the final, and then the final whistle goes, and you know you've won, and you've got to go up the steps and get a medal?
It's one of those unique experiences that at the time, I certainly made the most of it, with regards to just walking around and absorbing the crowd, even during the game. And I came on late in that game. I didn't start that game. It was a shame, but I felt still a part of the squad and the team, and came on and was on for the final goal. So that was nice. So when Graham Lee, I think, headed in the winner, it's nice to celebrate. And the echo around that stadium in Cardiff was phenomenal. So. Mm. It's all these kind of unique feelings, and all positive, or, you know, just euphoria almost. When we scored the goal, and two, when you hear the final whistle go and you hear the fans cheer, and just memories I'm happy I've been lucky to have, and winning any trophy in a professional game is a unique moment for me, and that's the way I see it. And it was certainly the foundation or the platform we use to springboard and progress up the league and get promoted and get into the Championship. But yeah, an amazing experience, one for the fans of Doncaster, two for the club and the players, and three for myself on a personal note.
Right, so was getting into coaching always the plan?
After spending time with Sean, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sean O'Driscoll was certainly a key influencer in me thinking about taking my licences, realising my attributes as a player that had gone through some hardships and adversity, but never switched off to learning or absorbing from all the managers I played under. And it's funny, it's only when you go back through your subconscious and your memories, what you have learned and what you have picked up. So I spent a little bit of time figuring out my coaching philosophy and what I'd like to do with regards to developing players and playing styles, and, you know, lots of layers of soccer coaching that, or football coaching that, that I'd never really thought of before. So it took up a lot of my time off the field, and I enjoyed it. I loved the analysis aspect of the game, and I loved figuring out how, one, to make myself a more efficient, more consistent player, and how that could help the team in turn be successful. So Sean certainly gave me the kickstart there, and thankfully I feel very fortunate to be able to pull on a lot of unique experiences and information from individuals that have been at the highest level of the game.
Did I read right that you spent a bit of time out in the Middle East?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I spent a little bit of time in Qatar with the Qatar national teams, only about 3 weeks, and that was enjoyable. It gave me a different perspective again, which I'm always looking for. Educating myself consistently on the game and the different environments and what makes players tick in those different environments. So it was good to see the Aspire Academy, Aspire yeah. Centre, where all the Qatar national teams from U14 up to the full national team train. And the Prozone element of it at that point, which is the analysis side of things, they had cameras everywhere, looking to pick up habits of players.
Yeah.
Do you walk the same route from the dressing room to the training fields every day? You know, certain things, just picking up habits from players and what their preferences are. And it was again another unique adventure, because there's plenty of quality out in Qatar. Technically, the players are all very good, and I find that in most places I travel to. I went to China for a few weeks as well before I retired and came to the US, and technical is never a problem. Technical ability can be refined over and over and over again. The same with physical attributes, providing you're blessed with good genes. You can improve all those things. It's now more the psychological factor that is a standout kind of attribute that needs to be refined and developed, and we need to find new ways to do that. So all of those experiences I've had abroad and in England have shown me certainly that it's the mental muscle that needs to be worked on a consistent basis in lots of different ways to kind of evolve, or that'll be the evolution of the game moving forward for me, because technically and physically most players now are almost maxing out.
Alright, so how did you first start coaching in America?
So I came over to a travel soccer company, which is the grassroots level, and people were saying, why are you going to travel soccer, like a grassroots level industry? I came over as a director of coaching, and certainly friends back home were questioning why I would want to do that, and I think the key to being the best coach possible is understanding the base layer of any player development, which means you need to understand the grassroots level of any environment. I understand the highest level, the most elite level, but what's the pathway? What are the building blocks in between that you need to get you from point A to point B? Point A being the grassroots, point B being a professional player. So I came over as a director of coaching. My first real coaching job, we were managing 500-600 youth players, so we had about... Actually, at the time, we only had 17 teams, so we'd be around maybe half that. And we grew the club to 45 teams in 2.5 years. So in the end, managing maybe 500 players and 60 coaches. But within that, you've got your curriculum development, your coach development, recruiting players, you know, just the organisational aspects of managing a budget. And for that big a club, that big an environment was a great learning curve for me. And although it was grassroots, I mean, parents here pay anywhere up to $4,000 a year to play soccer in their organised league. So it's like the mini pros.
Yeah.
It really is that organised. And yes, there are different ability levels in every club and every league. So you've got to manage that. And that was probably the hardest thing for me, the most difficult thing, dealing with the expectation from parents who, you know, want their kids to aspire to be something in the game, but also managing the different ability levels of coaches and players. You know, how do we integrate a uniform curriculum that has to be delivered in many different ways to many different players, and how do the coaches understand that and then pass on that delivery in an innovative, fun kind of way, because it is youth, it is grassroots development level sport. So It was a great experience and a great transition out of the game. For me personally, again, people would say I was crazy.
Yeah.
Leaving the UK, where I could have different opportunities to go into academies, and I'm jumping ship and going to to the US in travel soccer, not the professional game. But you know, 3 years down the line, I'm now working with my ex-teammate John Curtis in an elite player development program, which is the PDP. So myself and John run different regions for under the US club umbrella, which has 6 million players under its umbrella, or five, yeah, or six, I think. Where we have the best players selected by the DOCs, nominate them to come to the PDP events, and then they come to our Centre of Excellence sessions once a week. So we get the best players from different regions practicing together once a week from different clubs. And you know, this is the next phase again. I've kind of moved on from travel soccer into this environment where now we're looking to get players into what's called the ID2 program, which is the next phase of PDP, and then into the US national team pool. So there's lots of structure here and lots of opportunity for me to develop as a coach, but more importantly, pass on my experience and whatever I continue to learn in the future onto these players to give them the best chance of success.
Right, so what's the major difference between the British and the American development systems? It doesn't sound like there's academies. The clubs,
there are academies, yeah. Yeah. The MLS have academies. So travel soccer is your base layer of the pyramid.
Yeah.
And this is played, I think it's 9 million players registered, so actually registered to a system, either US Youth Soccer or US Club Soccer. That's the base of your pyramid. You then filter up into your National Premier Leagues or your ECNLs or your EDP, which is the top end of travel soccer in the US. And this is just in the New York region as well, bearing in mind it's 50 states and a lot of different organisations. So from that, you then go into DAs, which are development academies. So your development academies are, some are MLS academies and some are non-MLS academies. So I think there are about 94 clubs involved in the development academy programme. And the PDP programme that I'm currently working in is kind of tailored towards putting players into the DAs, the development academies, and also putting them into the ID2 program, which is the kind of last step before the US national team pools. So it's very structured. I mean, the grassroots level of the game is the most structured I've ever seen anywhere because of the money that's put in. Parents paying, you know, $3,000 to $4,000 a year to play soccer, times up by 6 to 9 million. It's a big industry, so it provides a really, really solid platform for player development. And there's a lot of talent over here, a heck of a lot of talent. One thing the United States do well is produce athletes. So with a little bit of good coaching and direction and psychological development, you can refine and develop players, and there's an abundance of them. The only hindrance or stumbling block for me is this transition into the college years. And that's where, say, a 16-year-old kid who's good enough to be at Man United is the same ability as a 16-year-old kid in the US who's probably at a Red Bulls academy or an NYCFC academy here, as examples. That player in the US still has 2 more years of high school, where the 16-year-old is going into the professional environment. So you imagine the next 5 years of development. The American player is going through high school for 2 years and then into college for 3 or 4 years and coming out in a draft at 21. The 16-year-old at United, you know, might have had a year in a youth team, a year in the reserves, and then straight into the first team if he's good enough. And he's got 3 years in a first-team squad trying to play games. So by the time they're both 21 years old, who's going to be ahead? So there are a couple of hindrances with the current US system for developing players, certainly. And that's one instance, I would say, of why they're not progressing as quickly as they are. But things are trying to change.
Yeah, we have interviewed coaches in the past from America, and they say the college, because colleges don't seem to, I don't want to say they don't care about development, but the winning is the be all and end all. So the players' development is kind of secondary to the winning.
It is, absolutely. They're focused on the W's, and sadly that does negate the responsibility we have as coaches to continuously develop. You know, we're teachers at the end of the day, and if you go into a classroom and you're sacrificing your students' education because you want better exam results so you get a bonus, you've got a moral and ethical issue there that you've got to deal with, and it's tough because you don't know anybody's personal circumstances either.
Yeah.
So there's so many layers behind inadequate coaching and teaching. But for me, certainly in college, the pressure is on coaches to win games, regardless of style of play, almost. And that's a tough one. There's also a big factor in their exams and the educational aspect of it. You know, these players have to keep their grades up, and they have standards to adhere to from an educational perspective in the classroom. So that can also be a hindrance as well. You say hindrance in the same breath. What percentage of players actually make it into the pros that come through the system? It's very small. So on one hand, you can't argue it. On the other hand, it's a hindrance.
Yeah. All right. So what's your plans for the future? Do you want to eventually get into management, or are you happy with the youth development?
Given my career so far, I tend not to look that far ahead. would I like to jump into the management at some point, see what I could do with a group of 20, 25 players, and see if I can impart my philosophies and coaching methodology on them to help them create something unique? Yeah, that does intrigue me. For now, I'm enjoying working with John and developing some real top talent in the northeastern United States. You know, it's a lot of fun. We get to work with great players. So for now, I'm enjoying that development cycle in my own development as a coach, I guess. But in the future, yeah, certainly. I think if the right opportunity arose for me to jump into management, or even as an AC, as I continue to educate myself, I think I would certainly look at it and weigh up all my options. And if it was right, if the environment was right, if the team was right, and I felt like I could go in there and have a positive impact and share my experience with players and coaches, then yes, I would certainly do it.
Yeah. All right, so before we finish, do you want to plug your social media and any current projects you have?
Current projects, social media, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, obviously, Mark Willow Wilson, or at Mark Willow Wilson is my Twitter page, and you'll find all manner of things on there. I don't tweet often, but when I tweet, I like to think it's about something worth tweeting about or retweeting about. In fact, I might as well say it. There's a technology, wearable technology product that'll be coming out for American youth soccer and possibly into Europe and the Far East over the coming years. There's a big focus on data, on players, and how affordable it is for the youth teams and grassroots level teams around the world at the moment. So I've been very fortunate to work with a company called Beyond Pulse and be a part of that as a shareholder, to try and bring this data and technology to grassroots youth sports at an affordable price, not the £50,000 or £100,000 you might have to pay for a Prozone system.
Yeah.
So look out for that in the future. Beyond Pulse will hopefully be making its mark with wearable technology in the next 8 to 12 months.
All right, so I've really enjoyed speaking today. Have a great Christmas.
Cool, Chris. Same to you, mate. Enjoy Christmas, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
I'd love to have you on again. We do an academy, like a youth development show, which I think we're bringing back in probably January, February. I'd love to have you on that to discuss more about your coaching and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I've plenty to share, mate. So, and I don't mind talking. So we're good to go.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, so thank you for coming up.
No worries, thanks, Chris. Okay. Cheers, mate. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.